Brackets, explanation. This is the start of tape number 3. This tape takes on from the end of tape number 2, side B, where I was talking about the return to Canada and the unexpected visit to St. John's, Newfoundland, to land a man with acute appendicitis. And I was explaining about coming in from the ocean suddenly through the gap in St. John's, Newfoundland, and you're right alongside. End of brackets, explanation. So as I was saying, in many ports, most ports in the world, you have a rather a long approach to a harbor. You may come 5, even 10 miles past various landmarks and avoiding shoals. However, in Newfoundland, all of a sudden you're in harbor. So we came alongside, still wrapped up in our winter seagoing warm clothing, and still, of course, from my point of view, up on my had been up in my sea cabin all the way across the rough North Atlantic winter weather. As we welcomed Admiral Taylor on board with his secretary, I took them straight to my day cabin, which I had not seen for 7 days. And Admiral Taylor was very genial, gave us a great welcome, said he was glad to see a fleet destroyer in port for a change rather than just the normal escorts. And we, with my first lieutenant, Yogi Jensen, and the navigator, Dick Steele, we sat around my cabin, and my excellent steward, Hardy, by name, from H-A-R-D-Y, from Port Mattoon in Nova Scotia. Hardy stood there ready to receive orders, and I asked the Admiral what he would like, and he said he would like a whiskey and water, and the secretary the same. So I followed suit, and so did the others. So good steward Hardy broke out the store of good Scotch whiskey and laid out the tumblers, gave a good portion to each, and topped them up with water, and passed them all around. We said, Admiral said, good to see you, Piers. Welcome to port. And we said, cheerio. And all of a sudden, gosh, I took a gulp of this whiskey, and it was terrible. I didn't know what had happened. Something had gone wrong. It seemed like salt water in the whiskey. So I said, Hardy, apologized to the Admiral, said, sir, let's have those back. And he didn't complain, but made a funny face, obviously agreeing that there was something wrong with the whiskey. So I said, Hardy, there's something wrong with that. Let's pour them again and give us some good fresh water. So Hardy went to the tap, let the water run, and cold fresh water, and another tray full of whiskeys and water were produced, and we said, well, better this time, cheerio, gentlemen. And by golly, it was the same thing. We had the same salt water in the whiskey. Well, we changed to, I think, to a glass of sherry at that stage, because what we found was that coming pounding across the Atlantic Ocean in the winter weather, we had sprung a leak in the fresh water tank, and the fresh water tank had rather filled up with salt water, so we were in fact having salt water with our whiskey on that occasion. Not a very nice way to treat your admiral when he comes aboard, but an amusing incident after all said and done. Well, we only stayed in Newfoundland about an hour and a bit, and then we wheeled the ship around in harbor and headed out, and down we went to Halifax, and I think we finally actually did make it on Valentine's Day after all, for a very happy reunion with families and friends after a period of in excess of a year. We were then, as far as I was concerned, obviously I was going to have a shore appointment as my next appointment. I probably received it just after I got into port, and I turned the ship over to Lieutenant Commander Phil Hatton, H-A-D-D-O-N, and for me, this was the end of 63 months of sea time during war. I just had that brief period ashore at the end of 1943 when I was training commander and had that rather exciting spy incident. So I was finally for the beach. It was a very pleasant change for me to to anticipate being at home with my wife and daughter. And there was a saying in our family that every day is a holiday when Daddy's home. And of course, all during the war, that seemed to be the case, because any time the ship was in for a few days, in Halifax particularly, since we usually work from Newfoundland and Londonderry, any time we were in port, it was always a time of great happy family reunions and great rejoicing. So indeed it was, every day was a holiday when Daddy's ship was in. The other expression, which I'm sure everybody has heard, is, why is Daddy so rich on board ship and so poor when he's at home? Well, perhaps it seems that way to young families, because on board, if you're a captain, you have your own quarters, you have your own cook and steward. Everybody on board is very polite to you, naturally, and you seem to have a pretty good life, well made, aboard ship. And then when you get ashore, you have to deal with the realities of the housing situation. You have to deal with the rather low pay that we had in those days. It was almost infinitesimal. And indeed, once you do get home, life is a little tougher. For me, getting a shore appointment, I was appointed to the training establishment Cornwallis down between Annapolis and Digby in Nova Scotia, and there I was to be the officer in charge of the officer's training. And it was to be my first permanent shore appointment. While I was on leave following the return to Halifax, my wife told me of a lot of the difficulties that she had faced during the absence, not only for the year that we were in Scapa Flow, but also all the time that we were on the North Atlantic. For the most part at that stage, we had a house down in Chester, Nova Scotia, and this was a small village, and of course, it was inevitable, perhaps. I had some Chester boys on board the ship with me. Now, one was not supposed to listen to that English traitor who became known as Lord Haha. This was an Englishman who deserted, as it were, to the enemy side, and he would give his daily explanation over the German radio beamed to the whole of the Western world to hear the story, propaganda put out by Germany. And he had such a la-di-da voice that he was dubbed by the British Lord Ha-Ha. And in fact, he took that name on himself. And he would broadcast every night, Lord Ha-Ha speaking, Lord Ha-Ha speaking. And he was such a successful propaganda item for the Germans that the Allies were actually forbidden to listen to him, but of course everybody did. Well, in the little village like Chester or even Halifax, the wives and families of the people who were at sea would listen into Lord Ha-Ha to see what he had to say about the Battle of the Atlantic and the battles up around Scapa Flow. And every night Lord Ha-Ha would say the battles were going on and the number of ships that were British ships, Canadian ships that were sunk by the German U-boats. And many, many times he had reported that way back my ship, the Restigouche, had been sunk in the battle in the mid-Atlantic by the U-boats, and on a couple of occasions the Algonquin had suffered a similar fate working out of Scapa Flow. Well, it was inevitable that members of the families of the crew would hear about this, and as soon as that report would come through, they'd ring up my wife and they'd say, oh, isn't it awful, the Restigouche has been sunk, isn't it terrible, the Algonquin has been sunk, and what are we going to do? Well, this made it very difficult for my wife, and as a matter of fact, how would she know at that stage whether, in fact, the report was not true? Happily, it never was. In the month of early April 1945, I took up my appointment at Cornwallis as officer in charge of the officers' training establishment. A few months later, I was given the additional responsibility of officer in charge of the navigation school, a job which I greatly cherished and I never specialized in navigation, but I always liked it, and I had, of course, a great deal of practical experience that I could pass on. And I was given the rank of acting commander, which is extremely nice, since very short time before that I had been actually confirmed in rank as a lieutenant commander. The officers' training establishment at Cornwallis consisted of many groups of young officers who had been promoted from the lower deck and were taking their first courses toward being trained as officers. And this was very interesting duty indeed, which I enjoyed thoroughly. These outstanding young men who would be outstanding in any Navy and probably should have been officer material in the very first place, but they'd won their spurs and were on their way up. And it was a great privilege for me to have the duty of teaching these fine young men what it really means to be an officer. About that time, we arrived at the 8th of May, which of course was VE Day in Europe. We had a modest celebration at Cornwallis. There were parades arranged and picnics and lots of beer for everybody, and we had all at Cornwallis. We had a very good time indeed in a reasonably quiet. There wasn't mad celebrations because the Japanese war was still to come, and victory perhaps in that area was a long, long way off. However, we'd finally beaten the Hun to the ground, and Hitler had committed suicide. Germany was practically destroyed. The Russians had entered Berlin, and the war in Europe was over on the 8th of May, 1945. Now, while we had a happy and pleasant time down at Cornwallis, there were terrible things going on in Halifax, the famous Halifax riots, which, to our terrible dismay, resulted in the dismissal, really, of Admiral Murray, who had been our great leader for so many years in the North Atlantic. On the very day of his ultimate triumph in the Atlantic, he was humiliated and rather hard to talk about this. There's a book has just been put out about Admiral Murray, which called Murray the Martyred Admiral, and I know that's the way all of us who were at sea felt about Admiral Murray. The cause of the Halifax riots, I'm a Haligonian myself, and I have rather mixed feelings about this. There's no doubt that the sailors in Halifax, about 10,000 of them, came down into the streets of Halifax, looted the liquor stores, and once the spirit began to bite, then all sorts of awful things happened. The great question, of course, is, or the point to be made, why, after 6 years of battle, nearly 6 years, should the liquor stores be closed on a day of victory? What was to happen to make a celebration for the sailors on that day? They were warned in advance. VE Day was a slightly uncertain date. It might have been the 6th, the 7th, 8th, 9th, or 10th of May, and the announcement came out, when VE Day is declared, the liquor stores will be closed. What an insult to the men who had fought for 6 years and finally achieved victory. However, this was a decision that was taken, and indeed it was done. So, Jolly Jack, with a sense of the fitness of things, really, said, well, if they lock it up, let's open them up. And by golly, they did open it up. And the results, of course, were disastrous for the reputation of the Navy and appallingly serious for our beloved leader, Admiral Murray. It wasn't long after that when preparations were being made for the final battle against Japan, that all of a sudden, on the 6th of August, the world was shattered by the fact that an atom bomb had been dropped on Hiroshima in Japan. And 2 days later, another atom bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, obliterating these two cities. None of us had heard of this atom bomb before. It was so super secret. and the history of that, of course, is well known to most people. What it did do, of course, was to precipitate the end of the war against Japan. It took some weeks before the surrender. Japan immediately indicated it would cease hostilities. It took several weeks before VJ Day was declared, and it's rather strange. I can honestly say I cannot remember when VJ Day was. I rather had to look it up and find it was somewhere around the 2nd of September that the final surrender of Japan was signed. We have, of course, a vivid picture memory of General MacArthur and others on the quarterdeck of one of the U.S. battleships taking the surrender of Japan. Canada was represented there, I think, by Captain Creery. I'm not too sure about that. But VJ Day suddenly came. There was not a great national outburst of relief. There were no huge parades in Halifax and other cities in Canada. It just seemed that people were weary and tired after 6 years of war, and thank God it was last finally over, and thank God that we had prevailed in that desperate struggle. It was just about that time when I personally was made the executive officer at Cornwallis for a short interim period before I proceeded to Stadacona, the naval barracks in Halifax, where I became executive officer in October of that 1945. There were 9,000 men, no less, on the books of Stadacona at that time, and the best duty that we could perform with the war over was to get people back into Civvy Street as soon as possible and get them back so that young men who were at school or university would not have to miss a year. And we applied all our efforts in Stadacona at that time to demobbing people as quickly as possible and getting them back to their own homes, to their own universities, and perhaps to jobs that were waiting for them. So there we are. That is the Second World War as seen through the eyes of somebody who was a very junior officer at the beginning, who was given enormous responsibility at a very tender age, who had ups and downs. One had to learn to take one's bumps, take successes as they came. Nobody ever told you about those. And it certainly for me was a very lucky period. I managed to go through 6 years of war without being torpedoed or sunk, although torpedoes were fired at my ship on several occasions. I was near missed by shells. I was almost caught ashore in France. Many, many things. I was privileged to be in on so many big operations, the chasing of the Tirpitz, although not in on the final kill. There I was when President Roosevelt met Winston Churchill for the first time. I participated in some of the large convoy battles, and certainly in Scapa Flow, the Russian convoys, the fleet operations off Norway were immensely exciting. I felt very fortunate to be young and healthy and to come out of all that experience unscathed mentally or physically. And for that, I thank God. That is the end of my story of the Second World War, and I hope this may be some use as a record of one man's war. Thank you very much.